heard a bit about it this morning, about this program. It's a commercially derived project to develop remote sensing instrumentation for the commercial sector. The presentation today will be given by Mr. Ed Roberts. And Ed works with Ospace and is currently an engineering manager there. He was the Phase A study manager for the Ares project, and now that the project is continuing, he will be involved in the instrument development for that project. So without any further, I'll pass over to Ed.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. For those that missed it, Ares stands for the Australian Resource Information and Environment Satellite, and as Mark said, it's a commercially focused program that is designed to take advantage of the work that's been developed in Australia on hyperspectral remote sensing, particularly by the CSIRO. The way we'll go through the talk is to talk about the ARES requirements and how they flow down into a series of design drivers, then to look at some of the analysis that's required to implement the baseline design, and then talk about what we've done in terms of the design to date. And at the end, I'll talk about data processing, just so you have a bit of a handle on the complexity of data processing that's required for this sort of hyperspectral data in order to get value from it. And that relates to the work that the CSIRO have been doing over a number of years. Now, these are a combination of landscape and portraits, and my apologies, a combination of different talks as well. Okay, the key aim of the ARES program is worldwide geological exploration via satellite. That's what the design is driven towards. Out of that come a number of subsidiary opportunities. The first of those is worldwide geological mapping. If you've got the data for specific customers and you've got a satellite going around the world, you pick up the world geology as a byproduct, and obviously a very useful one. Because of the data set that we're taking, it turns out that there's likely to be a significant interest from the environmental and agricultural communities, or from our perspective, I guess, markets. In order to make sure that we in fact tap into a market and not just a bunch of interested bystanders, the design process has to be highly responsive to what the user actually needs. And that's a combination of what they need versus what we can give them, and what they need versus what they want, so that there's some balance between design sophistication, cost, and the marketplace. The program will be commercially funded and driven. The Phase A for this program was undertaken last year. About three quarters of the money for the Phase A came from the mining or related industries through the Australian Mining Industry Research Association, AMIRA, down here in Melbourne, and about a third of it came from the Australian Space Office. ILIO's not here right now, but thanks, ILIO. The ARES program was the winner of the shootout that the Space Office ran for ideas for light sets for Australian development and potential launch at that stage. Okay, so what is the ARES satellite firstly? It's a light satellite based hyperspectral remote sensor. It includes telescope and spectrographs, which provides the hyperspectral data, thence the electronics to compress, store and downlink the data. Critically, it's a single instrument satellite, which we think is important to keeping the cost down and the risk down. And as I've mentioned, it's commercially focused. We're building what we can sell, as opposed to what we can derive satisfaction or excitement from, I guess. Firstly then, to set the scene for how we design the instrument, to define imaging spectrometry, what we're doing is subdividing the reflected light from the sun, reflected from the Earth's surface, into a large number of spectral channels, in our case 128 channels, which compares to things like SPOT and Landsat, which are perhaps a half dozen channels, three in the case of SPOT and about seven in the case of Landsat, which are fairly broad channels. In our case, we're subdividing into very narrow channels, and it's an imaging spectrometer. We're not only finding the spectrum of a point on the ground, we're creating an image of the ground, and for every point on that ground, we're providing 128 spectral points. So it's shown here, basically we have a long slit image formed, and as the satellite moves, of course, that slit motion translates into a 2D image. And then for every single swath, we get a series of spectra across that slit. The first observation you can make is that we're dealing with an awful lot of data as a result, and we'll come to the problems that leads to. Okay, so that's imaging spectrometry, and that can be done from aircraft, and it can be done from the ground, and both those approaches are used today. So why use a satellite? I mean, we're all interested in space, so it may seem obvious to us, but when you're putting money down, and it's a lot of money, why use a satellite rather than, say, an aircraft? Firstly, we're talking about global coverage. We want to operate a satellite from Australia to allow Australian and overseas companies to explore globally, and we want to sell data around the world. And a satellite gives you global coverage. It's also comparatively low cost. Satellites are robots. Once you've got it up there, the incremental cost of the next bit of data is low. From a data processing perspective, it gives you constant observation time and sun angle, which means that from the with respect to the ability to interpret the data, life's a bit easier. And of course, because you're a long way up, the geometric distortion associated with the image is low, and that's also important in terms of quality data. We talked to the users through a series of user forums during the Phase A study, obviously at the start and during it and then at the end. And those users were not only in Australia but also in the US and in Europe, and particularly the people in the CSIRO, Dr. John Huntington and his crew, were very good at identifying the users and getting out there and finding out what they wanted. But I guess we had a reasonable idea at the beginning. The users, from a geology perspective, are particularly interested in the shortwave infrared from 2 to 2.5 microns. That's where all their geology happens. But they want information from 400 to 1,000 nanometres in the visible, and some information from 1 to 2 microns in the shortwave infrared information about the atmosphere. Particularly the 400 to 1,000 is about vegetation, because as a geologist, vegetation is that which is getting in the road, so if you can find out it's there, you can take it out of your data processing. And from 1 to 2, there's some information about the atmosphere, there's some additional information about vegetation, and there's a bit of geology as well. The geologists want signal-to-noise, more so than either high spectral resolution or high spatial resolution. This number 400 to 1 comes out of a lot of work that the CSIRO has done, backed up by work using one of the JPL instruments, Avaris, which is the airborne visible and infrared scanner, which flies on a U2. And that produces data at about 400 to 1 signal to noise. It actually, I think, produces somewhat higher spectral resolution, which helps validate the requirement for a lower spectral resolution than we might have otherwise thought. We don't require particularly high spatial resolution. Generally, outcrops of minerals are reasonably large, and the data processing methodologies allow you to look within a pixel to find out what the constituents are in any case. The hyperspectral image is 30 metres, but we're also flying a panchromatic imager, which is basically to give the geologist an image of the ground that he can relate to. It's a sort of human factors thing. And we're deciding to fly it rather than buy it from somebody else so that we know that the two data sets are properly co-registered. And because of the price of buying 5 years' worth of data from a third party and having to do all the data navigation and so on. One of the requirements that didn't exist when we started the program and was fed into the program as a result of feedback from the marketplace was that they weren't interested in fairly coarse positioning. Our initial spec was to position to within about 5 pixels or 150 metres on the ground without ground control points. And the users came back and said, no, we really want to know, just off the satellite data, exactly where the area of interest is so that we can go out and peg a claim. We really want to be able to get down to sub-pixel. And so our goal is 15-metre geolocation without any ground control points. And that turns out to be quite a design driver. And it's an example of something that was made harder for us as engineers during the program as opposed to easier so far. The revisit time, 7 days, with off-axis pointing, in other words, the ability to point off-axis to quickly revisit a given point, is really driven by the ability to get back to a scene that you requested and was covered by cloud rather than a desire to repetitively monitor a scene. Obviously, the agricultural and environmental markets have that requirement, but from a geological perspective, it's more the ability to be fairly sure that you'll quickly get a scene. Geologists don't only have a geological time frame; they are interested in seasonal variation of the ground cover so that they can take out some of the vegetation information. But they're not particularly turned on by rapid revisit for its own sake. In order to get enough data to be saleable and pay the program off, we need at least 3 years of life, and we're designing it for at least 5 years of consumables and so on. and it'll be in a low sun synchronous orbit. I'll come to the orbit analysis shortly. Just to get into people's minds the sort of size of satellite we're talking about, this is the ill-fated Lewis satellite at a time when it wasn't ill-fated. This shows the platform and this shows the integrated satellite. And the point of putting this up is to show the sort of size of satellite we're talking about. Ares will be this sort of size and shape. And in the case of HSI, that's the platform, that's the avionics bay, and that's the instruments. And the current configuration that we're proposing for Ares is a bit different, but it may turn out that it will end up this way. There's a bit of a trade going on at the moment. But you can see they're fairly compact satellites, but they're by no means small, and they're also very sophisticated. Unfortunately, of course, Lewis had a problem in early operation. The batteries ran flat, and that was it. We hope that won't happen to us. But the TRW platform is one of the three candidate platforms that we're looking at, so I guess we're looking at what happened there. Okay, well, having found out from the users what it was that they wanted, that led to the drivers on our design. The signal-to-noise in the shortwave infrared 2 was the thing that drives the optical design, particularly in terms of aperture and the detectors. Once you go to a large aperture for a fixed pixel on the ground and a fixed detector pixel, it means you have fast optics. And as anyone who's bought a high-speed lens knows, that means complex and costly optics, and that's quite a driver in terms of design, both of the optics and the structure it's associated with it. The ability to navigate the image to less than a pixel means that we need to put high-precision star trackers near the optical bench to take out any flexure and thermomechanical distortions. We need an intrinsically stiff structure, and we need low microvibration. Microvibration is something that you generally don't think about on a satellite, but you've got a bunch of mechanisms like reaction wheels and things. They're all rumbling and rattling and shaking around. In our case, we have cryocoolers. So you've got something that's fairly light that's being perturbed by its own operation, and we need to understand that and control it. Because we operate in the shortwave infrared, we need cold detectors, which in turn means that we need some form of cooling. Because we're pointing off axis to get good revisit times, it means that we can't use a radiative cooler, and they have disadvantages anyway. So we're forced to a mechanical cooler, which is costly, has a limited life, and leads to microvibration. But I think we're reasonably happy that the technology's there. I mentioned that we have a massive data volume, and that leads to large solid-state recorders and high-rate downlinks. The reason for recorders is so that we can do over-the-horizon imaging, so that we can get as much data as we can to archive and sell. The last issue is that we're after remote measurement, or quantitative remote sensing. What that means is that we need accurate calibration, pre-launch and on-orbit. The on-orbit calibration being a combination of inbuilt calibration capability and calibration via observation of the ground and the atmosphere. And that is also one of the drivers. But it's one of the things that will make Ares unique and hopefully, therefore, highly saleable. OK, this shows where Ares is operating, and it leads to a bit of an observation about one of the problems. So here's 0.4 and here's 2.5, and that top line is basically the solar spectrum that's illuminating the ground, or that which you would see if you're on orbit looking at the sun. What's coming back, as you can see down here, is not very much. Now, here are the two water vapour areas that are where the atmosphere is opaque, or I guess a combination of water vapour and other things. Here are two water vapour features that we're interested in. Turns out water vapour is the single hardest thing for the geologists to unmix from the image, so we're particularly interested in those points as a way of figuring out, for every pixel, how much water is in the image. But down here, as you can see, there's not a lot of flux, and that's the thing that's driving the design. The baseline design of Ares, then, is a single instrument spacecraft, a simple set of interfaces between the platform and the instrument. And one of the reasons for that is that we're not proposing to develop a platform indigenously. We're buying a platform. We're designing and building and qualifying and characterising an instrument. When we bring them together, we want to have a limited number of interfaces that we have to control so that we're not going to be forever in the AIT phase burning up money at the platform supplier's facility. The design is a three-mirror anastigmatic telescope, which is starting to become a standard design for this sort of mission. The latest Indian remote sensing satellite flew a TMA, Lewis had a version of a TMA. Coupled to that will be probably two spectrographs. They'll be prism-based spectrographs because that is high throughput, low dispersion. We don't require, as I said, particularly high spectral resolution, and prisms are nice. You're not throwing away the second and third and fourth order energy from the scene, and you're not getting order overlap problems, and you're not getting scatter. You do have radiation-induced darkening of the prisms to contend with, but that is not a big issue for us. 2D focal planes, your standard silicon CCD, and mercury cadmium telluride on silicon in the shortwave infrared. X-band downlink, which again, part of the payload, not the platform, in order to keep that interface simple. We're talking about 150 megabits a second downlink, and trying to feed that into the platform and then control both the technical and the contractual issues when things don't quite work out seem to be a bit risky. So this shows the overall block diagram, and basically the flux comes in here, the signal goes down there, and the platform is underneath. The interface is between the platform and the instrument of the power calibration system to check the flux coming off the calibration system. So it's a sort of belt and braces approach, but we're pretty confident that that'll give us good results. It has been pointed out to us in a review we did recently that we don't actually need solar flux. We can probably get away with incandescent lamps, vacuum enveloped incandescent lamps, vacuum so that they don't change between ground and orbit in their properties. This shows the optical bench structure. Basically, we have the internal structure here, which is the optical bench made out of carbon fibre. There's the telescope, there's the hinged cover at the front, there's the calibration system at the back. So this is the sun here, and that's the ground there. And then here's the spectrograph. And that is all sitting on three mounts here isostatically within an external structure. The lid part of that's taken off in that picture. So there's the ground, and there's this external structure. And the aim is to control thermally the internal structure to keep everything nice and stable. Again, the external structure would be a carbon fibre honeycomb. I won't say much about the focal planes other than that they are fairly high tech. The visible focal plane will be silicon. You'd think it's fairly standard, but in fact it's a custom format and fairly demanding. It's got to run at 250 hertz frame rate, which is quite a lot higher than standard TV rates, so we're really pushing it quite fast. The shortwave infrared, it turns out, is not as technically demanding, which kind of surprised me. Been doing a lot of modelling of signal to noise using LOTRAN in this case, and making assumptions about what the signal and noise sources are, well, the noise sources that impinge on the signal are. And in this sort of modelling, we're not assuming that scattered light from the atmosphere is a noise source. We assume it's just part of the flux. And we're not taking into account in this modelling errors in calibration. So there's a defined set of things that we assume are noise. And this shows that we are, that this is the visible. We have a target of 1,000 to 1 SNR and a requirement of 600 at 600 nanometers. You can see that based on these commercials, well, not commercial, but CCDs from known suppliers, we meet that. And then here we have a requirement of 400 to 1 at 2.2 nanometers. And you can see that in all these cases, 30 degrees off axis, sorry, that's 30 degrees solar zenith angle with respect to the instrument, we meet those requirements. So the modelling suggests that the instrument will perform as required. Okay, I mentioned the high data flow rate. This gives us a bit of a handle on it. Three focal planes. The shortwave infrared has 96 spectral channels, 512 spatial or cross-track channels. That leads to 150 megabits a second of data. That's 12-bit quantized data. The visible focal plane is nominally 32 spectral elements by 512, 50 megabits. And then the pan, which is running three times as fast because the pixel is one-third the size, 9 megabits. The pan will probably only be quantized to 8 bits because we're not after signal to noise there particularly. So we have over 200 megabits a second of data going into the data handling electronics. It will select some of the data and reject others. In the shortwave infrared one, there's not a market, a justifiable market to bring all that data down and try and sell it. There's only some information that's of mandatory interest, that water vapor absorption feature in particular. So the data handling electronics will extract that water vapor feature at the highest spectral resolution and then bin everything else spectrally so that instead of a 15 to 20 nanometer resolution, we have a
a 30 to 40 nanometer resolution. So over 200 coming in and 150 coming out. In fact, in the middle of the data handling, we're also doing compression so that we're reducing it by a factor of 2. And there's a solid-state recorder that takes that compressed data. Down here we have an instrument computer, and then that's talking to the platform via a 1553 bus at low speed. And you'll note that we do, in fact, have an instrument computer. There was a suggestion that we go with the platform computer. But again, from the perspective of keeping the interfaces simple, we felt it was best to have our own processor so that the instrument could be fully tested and characterised in Australia against a platform simulator, and we wouldn't be having to put our software routines into somebody else's code, risking problems with the life of the health of the platform and so on. Another view of the data handling electronics then, three lots of serial data coming in at high speed using hot link interfaces, that'd be transformer coupled. The data selection and binning that I mentioned, particularly in SWIR 1. Lossless data compression. This will probably use a chip called the user's chip, the universal source encoder for space chip from the University of New Mexico, which is a chip developed for NASA. According to the CCSDS, that will give us more than 4.2 or so to 1 compression on this sort of data. We're assuming it'll give us 2 to 1 lossless compression, but there's hopefully some headroom there. They've been using the Avaris data set to look at how much compression you can get. That's a commercially available chip, space qualified. It's 4.5K US, although you have a minimum order of 25. It's a bit of a bummer. So if Brian's here, we can maybe do a deal on his compression. And then the packetising into a Landsat 7 format, the CCSDS Landsat 7 format, out of the solid-state recorder. This reference to core is a potential set of equipment that we might use coming out of a Matra Marconi program in the UK. We may develop a lot of that from scratch. Having stored that data, brought it back out, we then need to downlink it. This is showing a dual redundant chain in order to get the reliability up. A modulator taking IQ data at 75 megabits per second on INQ, translating it to the 8.3 gig roughly, running through a solid state preamp, sort of power amp, thence through a filter output switch, and then to one of two antennas. The main mode of operation will be a narrow beam high gain horn on a two-axis positioning mechanism. Should that fail, we would switch over to a low gain fixed antenna, because for most passes of ground stations, a low gain is fine. But we need to size the telemetry link, or the data link, for the worst case, which is basically looking one way for off-axis pointing while trying to transmit the other way to a ground station. That's one of the user constraints that we're not quite sure will remain, that we downlink an image simultaneously. The other reason for that is that in an altazimuth mount, or like an altazimuth telescope, if you're passing over nadir, or zenith, I guess, in a telescope, the angular rates on the mechanism are high. And in that case, of course, the link is short and the link losses are low, so that we would use the fixed antenna in those cases rather than try and run the mechanism too hard.
Where does the power from the other amplifier go?
It's cold redundant, so only one's turned on at a time. Yeah. Basically, the whole of the instrument will be dual redundant and cold redundant. This shows the accommodation of the electronics within the structure. Basically, this is the structure that sits on the platform, which is under there, and the optical subsystem sitting within it. Those are the star trackers, so this is looking away from the ground, and again, trying to avoid the sun, looking both ways. That's the input to the calibration subsystem. And then on the east and west walls, which are the cold walls, we've got the electronic subsystems. And these would probably actually hinge down during AIT so that we could get to the thing and test it and put breakout boxes in and so on. And as I say, that's a carbon fibre aluminium honeycomb structure. Okay, here's another picture of the structure from a mechanical perspective for those of you who like Nastran. This was done with Nastran and Patran. This work was done in Bristol for us. This shows the external structure here. So that's the east wall, and this is cut in half. That's the east or west wall that we just showed. That's the ground down this way. This obviously is the key bit, because we can't afford large distortions in the structure in terms of keeping the optics in good alignment. So detailed analysis of the distortions, which are thermomechanical, those due to G release, the change from 1G to 0G, and those due to dewatering of carbon fibre, those sorts of things have been analysed. And the results of that analysis were quite interesting. They showed that with an assumed 2 Newton input from the cryocooler, this thing, how am I going? Okay. The instrument was pitching around its isostatic mounts by about half a pixel, which was rather more than we wanted in order to both keep the image quality up and keep the data navigation capability up. So, I mean, the fix for that was to stiffen up these bits here. It also showed that in terms of thermal analysis between the ground and flight without heaters, you'd get about 1 pixel shift in the overall structure. So, interesting analysis. This shows the results of thermal modelling. I don't know, thermal guys must be in a world of their own because they gave us results that assume no heaters, whereas, of course, you would fly heaters. So this shows the quiescent case if you launch it and then don't add any heater power. And this is the optical bench area. You can see that everything sits at around 5 degrees. So there was a 15-degree swing in this case, I think these are beginning of life numbers, between what we'd align at in the lab and what it would fly at. And so that gave a bit of a change in pointing vector. And surprisingly, this shows that the primary, secondary, tertiary mirror are actually quite stable over each of these orbits, whereas the beam splitter, or slit area, where I guess all the energy is being concentrated, would be going up and down in temperature quite considerably. Then this shows the electronic units, again, the per-orbit variation in temperature. And in reality, of course, heaters would be used to bring the optics up to 20 degrees and to stabilise the electronics. Obviously, keeping the electronics around zero would be quite good if we could do it. Okay, in terms of launch, this shows the launch configuration of Ares. This is shown on a Cosmos. We've looked at US and Russian launch vehicles. And the Russian launch vehicles, the Cosmos and the Eurocot, are both of interest. In America, the Pegasus is slightly too small for us now. So LMLV and the big brother of the Pegasus,
Taurus,
yeah. Would be applicable. The American launches, of course, are quite a bit more expensive than the Russian ones, but I guess there's a while before we need to commit. Other comments. During launch, we'd need to lock the antenna pointing mechanism, we'd need to lock the cover, and, of course, need to lock the solar arrays. So there are some pyros or wax motors or something that we need to fly. So there's two or three that are involved in the payload and one or two involved in the platform. This shows a fairly hard to read picture of the instrument side of things. So the ground is that way, the sun is this way, and then those are the star trackers looking in anti-velocity direction. That's the cryocooler electronics down there. That's the external structure around the optical bench. The overall satellite, which weighs about 480 kilos wet at launch, this is showing it. This is looking away. I think. No. This is looking from the ground, so that's the input to the telescope. It's one of the S-band. No, that's one of the X-band antennas. That's the S-band TT and C antenna. The launch adapter, the instrument cryocooler, 4 solar array panels, which in this case are not running on a tilting mechanism. They are fixed. The reason for that is that we can make them stiffer so that there's less problem with microvibration, and so that we can, because they're stiffer, flip the satellite faster on its roll axis so that we can quickly point from point to point. It takes about 2 minutes, we think, to move the thing from one orientation to another. The requirement we had on the platform vendors when we went out to tender was 5 minutes, and by fixing the antennas in this approach with the arrays, it's a faster rate. The diagrams I've shown have been for the Matra platform, which are called LeoStar. That's basically because Matra have been working with us on the post-phase A work rather than because Matra have been selected. We've looked at three groups, TRW, Orbital Sciences and Matra, as potential platform vendors, and that process is still open. I'll conclude just by talking a little bit about hyperspectral geology, just to reinforce how difficult the task is for the instrument. This shows a whole series of mineral species. This is from work by John Huntington on avarice data, and all these spectra look pretty similar. Trying to distinguish this one from this one, for instance, is a bit of an ask, or this one from this one. And yet we've got to do that for 512 pixels by 256 frames every second. We need to make sure that the data quality coming down is such that that information isn't lost. So that's the geologically interesting bit, and everything else is additional data, if you like, from a geologist's perspective. Not going to talk to that other than to say that you can see there's a cartload of data processing to be done. And what's more, it's done on every pixel in the image. You can't, for instance, assume that the water vapour in the image is constant, because clouds have got structure and the unseen water vapour has structure. For every pixel in the image, you have to do ModTran backing out of the water, and you've got to do this, that and the other. It's a very complex lot of processing. But of course, the beauty of processing is that as software and hardware gets faster, that problem starts to go away. And that's one of the reasons that ARIES is now a feasible program, along with the sophisticated understanding of the problem that the CSIRO research has delivered, coupled with the NASA research at JPL and so on. This is a simulation. This is taken over Oatman in Arizona using avarice, but binned spectrally and spatially to look like ARIES would look. And this is a three-colour composite of an area, just to show what the image would look like at 30 metres. John runs through his processing methodologies, John Huntington, and comes up with a mineral map. So this shows the same scene, a 10-metre panchromatic image, and then the results of his mineral processing showing three different minerals. And those are the spectra for the three minerals. Those are the areas where those minerals are predominant. And this is the product that would be given, not given, would be sold to a geologist. Quite some money. Might be given to a few favoured ones initially. And this is what he will take out into the field. It's a map, it's got grid coordinates, and it says if you go to this point and you hit a rock, that rock is going to be muscovite. And if that sounds like a fairly heroic statement, this sort of processing and prediction and analysis has been validated for several years now using the avarice program, and people are pretty confident about it. This just shows another way of presenting that data. This is that data draped over a 3D terrain model. DTMs are a great way of chewing up computer time and people's interest. Okay, the implementation phase, to conclude, a three-year program nominally, 36 months, which turns out to be pretty tight. There's a lot to be done. The instrument would be developed in Australia. The spacecraft AIT would be done at the platform supplier, which in this case will either be the US or France. Launch on either a US or a Russian vehicle. In parallel, a so-called application development program. Again, Brian alluded to that this morning as part of the FEDSAT program. That's a means to make sure that on day one, when data starts flowing out of the facility, we don't have a bunch of would-be customers saying, oh, hyperspectral, well, I should learn a bit about that, and 2 years from now I'll start buying data. What we want is that people will be clamouring for data on day one, because they will have spent several years, this three-year period, learning about the information based on airborne data and so on. When this slide was done, we were undertaking Head Start activities pre-Phase B. We had a so-called Red Team review in Toulouse about 2 weeks ago of that Head Start program, and then we had a review at board level of the proposal, which actually occurred Thursday evening our time, and it's been given the tick internally, so we're pretty happy about that. And that was looking at both technical and financial issues and schedule issues. Okay, to conclude, first commercial hyperspectral program aimed at geology. There are a couple of hyperspectral programs in the wings. Lewis was never going to be commercial, but it was a sort of pre-commercial program. Warfighter is going to be commercial, but it won't be aimed at geology. Programs like GEROS, if they get up, will be commercial, but more aimed at the agricultural community. There will be significant application to the environment and agribusiness. The Phase A study suggested that it could be done, and could be done in a logical manner. The Head Start study indicated that it can be done. I mentioned the Phase A was funded by a combination of the Space Office and the mining industry. The Head Start, which has taken about as long and as many resources, was funded internally by Matra Marconi and Ausspace. The program will be commercially funded. Macquarie Bank is out there beating the bushes looking for money at the moment, and we're waiting on the tax office to sign off on the funding methodology. The user community will continue to be involved in the program, and you can find out more about it at that website. The schedule as of today for the program is that it will start hopefully in March next year, which means that on a 36-month program, it will be launched in March 2001.